Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
With rumors of a deal afoot, we'll do the math for you on student loans. We'll do some daily life on the streets of Cairo and fiction from the trading floor. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 11th of July. Glad you could download us today, everybody. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note ended this Thursday at 2.57%. I mention it here because it's looking like the 10-year might, and I stress might, be part of how Congress resolves its latest dilemma: what to do about student loans. Rates for new subsidized loans basically doubled last week to 6.8% because, in part, Republicans wanted one thing, the president wanted another, Democrats yet a third, and oh, by the way, any agreement couldn't cost the government too much money. Therein lies our story. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has it.
Part of the debate over what interest rate Congress should set for student loans has been about whether Congress should set interest rates for student loans. So let's go back for a moment to the early 2000s. Back then, 6.8% seemed like a good deal for students, says Brookings' Matt Chingas. Now, with mortgage rates and other rates so low, it seems kind of crazy.
The problem with having Congress set a specific rate is that that's the rate, and then the market moves around that rate. So you can get into a situation like right now where it seems like, oh, 6.8%, that's too high. Or you can get into the opposite situation where it seems like students are getting too good of a deal.
Democratic leaders in the Senate had, until late last night, wanted to keep rates locked low for a while. They've given in, so now all the different plans out there have something in common. They want to attach student loans to the rate on a 10-year Treasury note, plus a few extra percent.
This brings interest rate costs down for almost all borrowers.
That's Justin Drager, president of the National Association of Student Aid Administrators. In the case of the new Senate compromise, undergraduate loans would be about 4.5% today, less than the current 6.8%, though not quite as low as the previous 3.4%. The main differences among plans now are over details.
They're all just using different rates, but then they're tinkering with the borrower benefits, the repayment benefits.
Like a percentage point here or there, and whether rates should be fixed or variable, and what the cap should be. Differences that shouldn't be too hard to hammer out, say analysts. Then again, this is Congress we're talking about. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
This news today from Cairo. Former President Mohamed Morsi's Minister of Supplies gave an impromptu press conference tonight, in which he said that Egypt has less than 500,000 tons of wheat on hand. That's a big problem when you consider that that country is the world's biggest importer of wheat, about 10 million tons a year. And it does make you wonder about daily life out on the streets of Cairo. That is where reporter Kimberly Adams is based. Kimberly, it's great to talk to you again.
Likewise.
It's been, a week and a half or so now. What is daily life like for the average Egyptian today?
It's very tense. People are really concerned about some of the incidences of violence that have happened over the past week and a half, and really not sure what's going to happen next in terms of their personal lives or the economy. But at the same time, Ramadan just started here, so people are trying their best to embrace what should be a pretty festive season, despite the fact that all this is going on.
What about going out to the store and getting a loaf of bread or buying gas? I mean, are those things coming back? Are they easier now?
Before Morsi's ouster a week and a half ago, there were huge lines at gas stations, especially if you were trying to get diesel or just fill up your tank. And there were all these power outages as well, some of these main reasons that people were actually complaining about Morsi and wanting him out of office. All of a sudden, these things have ceased to happen. I'm standing outside a gas station in Cairo right now, where a week and a half ago, there were lines almost half a mile long. And now there's hardly anyone here. People are just, you know, getting their cars washed and having no problems getting gas at all.
What does a liter of unleaded go for over there now, just for the heck of it?
A liter of unleaded goes for about 26, 27 cents.
26 cents American?
It's heavily subsidized.
Wow. Last time we talked, Kimberly, you had mentioned that there was this middle tier of businesses that were having a tough time with their customers. You know, the local shops were doing fine and the big companies were doing fine, but those middle ranks of businesses weren't, their customers weren't physically able to get out on the streets and get there. Is that change now? Is there pedestrian traffic and those kinds of things?
Those businesses are reopening, but the problem is now that it is Ramadan, which means that the businesses have to cut back on their hours anyway because people are fasting from sunrise to sunset. And so people are supposed to be coming out late at night to celebrate, but because of the unrest, some people don't want to be out late at night.
What about the new government, the Prime Minister, Mr. Al-Bablawi, and how popular perceptions are there? I mean, he's an economist. Are people thinking he's actually going to be able to do anything, or are they just sort of marking time?
It actually already is doing something. He is a prominent economist. He is well known in the region and has a lot of regional contacts, and we've really seen that come to fruition because in the past, just since Morsi's ouster, Egypt has been pledged more than $12 billion in grants and loans from other Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait. And there are reports that even today they were in talks with Bahrain for more money. And what that influx of cash is going to do is it's going to help the government keep up its subsidies and keep up its programs that sort of keep the population happy, whether those be gas subsidies or bread subsidies, and basically kind of counteract some of this public angst that was really weighing on Morsi towards the end of his time in office.
Kimberly Adams on the streets of Cairo for us. Kimberly, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Back here at home, Wall Street was loving Ben Bernanke today. Record highs on the Dow and the S&P. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Back, 35-something years ago, Bill Gates started a little company you might have heard of with visions of a personal computer on every desk and in every home. That was then. Now, it's all about the cloud and mobile and definitely not boxy old personal computers. So the guy who came after Bill Gates at Microsoft announced a shakeup today. Shannon Mullen breaks it down for us.
Microsoft employees got a long email this morning from CEO Steve Ballmer, 2,700 words, outlining a new strategy he's calling One Microsoft. Bottom line, Ballmer wants the company to be more agile and collaborative.
If you want to pivot to the organization, then those are all the right words to be using.
Jay Fleesauer is a software analyst at Griffin Securities.
Your observation of what's going on in the world is that corporations and consumers are changing the way they interact and use technology.
Especially mobile devices. Microsoft is falling behind competitors like Apple and Google. So instead of separate divisions for each product, the company's reorganizing by function. Among them, marketing, strategy, and new engineering teams for devices and the cloud. John Furrier is editor-in-chief of SiliconANGLE.
Microsoft essentially is admitting in this reorganization that the fragmentation of their products and their strategy has failed.
Microsoft says there won't be layoffs, but it is moving some top executives around. Longtime Microsoft analyst Rick Sherland at Nomura Securities says Ballmer's strategy is long on rhetoric, but short on specifics.
It doesn't quite address the concern that investors have, which is where are you in smartphones and where are you in tablets? So it's a good structural change, but it kind of doesn't solve the problem that you have currently.
CEO Ballmer says there's still a lot to do. His closing words to employees, let's go. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
You know how we were talking about daily life in Cairo with Kimberly Adams a couple of minutes ago? The Census Bureau comes out with snapshots of daily life in this country from time to time. Data from the 2011 American Housing Survey, Where We Live and How We Live, was released today. So here you go. Here's some of it. The median year that occupied homes in this country were built, that is, where exactly half are newer and exactly half are older, was 1974. A little under half of owner-occupied homes in this country have working carbon monoxide detectors. Interesting. About three-quarters of Americans who own their homes have central air conditioning. And here you go, the last one. The median monthly mortgage payment for homeowners, again, back in 2011, was $1,015. Plenty more where that came from at Marketplace.org. Coming up,
we took a crisis where we start paying attention. And really, you know, a trading floor is economics in action.
In fact and in fiction. But first, let's do the numbers. Ben Bernanke gave a speech last night after the close and basically said, everybody relax, we're not raising rates anytime soon. And thus, the really happy music. The Dow Industrials closed at 15,460, up 169 points, 1.1%, a new record high. The NASDAQ added 57 points, 1.6%, ended things at 3,578. The S&P 500 up 22 points, 1.4%. Closed at, yes, a record 1675. Tech stocks led the charge. AMD chipped up nearly 12% today. As analysts recommended a buy on the processor maker. Microsoft moved up 2.8% after that big reorg we were talking about. Bond prices, I already gave this to you, but I'll do it one more time. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.57%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its producer price index for June. Wells Fargo releases quarterly earnings. And name the year the game show Family Feud premiered on TV. Survey says July 12, 1976. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know those two-year contracts you sign when you buy a new cell phone? That's pretty much the price you have to pay to have carriers subsidize the full cost of it. And if your timing is off, if the hot new thing comes out right after you do your deal, tough beans. Until Sunday, that is. That's when T-Mobile says it's going to start letting its customers upgrade twice a year for the low, low fee of just $10 a month. So, deal or no deal? Marketplace's Queen of Kim got the assignment.
T-Mobile's new plan is called Jump, and it taps into the modern desire to upgrade. We met up with Javon Johnson in downtown L.A. He says he'd love to trade up his iPhone, but...
While I'm a tech guy, the desire to get a new phone every year will be trumped by how much it'll cost me to do that.
So what does it cost? John Butler is an analyst at Bloomberg Industries, and he says it's a little complicated.
Let's take a step back and look at the current T-Mobile plan.
Butler says right now, if you want to buy an iPhone from T-Mobile, you have to pay $150 up front. Then over 2 years, you have to pay $20 a month to pay off the phone. That's a grand total of $630, or about the price of an iPhone. But you don't have to lock into a two-year plan.
Under the new Jump plan, T-Mobile is allowing customers to pay, instead of $20 a month, $30 a month, or the option of upgrading their phone every 6 months.
If you decide to upgrade, you have to turn in your old iPhone, plunk down another $150 for the new one, and the two-year payment plan starts all over again.
It's not cheap, really, for your average guy.
Butler says Jump only works if the customer actually upgrades twice a year. Ross Rubin is a consumer tech analyst at Redical Research. He says there's another way of looking at this.
It's really how the charges are presented to consumers.
Rubin says the $10 also includes insurance for your phone in case it breaks. That's in line with the price other major carriers are charging for insurance, but T-Mobile is throwing in the ability to upgrade. I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
The Energy Department was out with a new report today about threats to the power grid brought on by hotter, more severe weather. Power plants shutting down because their supply of cooling water is too hot. Wildfires burning up transmission lines and droughts holding up river barges carrying coal. All of those have already happened, the department says. We should expect more, is the gist of this report, and prepare accordingly. One way to protect electricity supplies, even theoretically robust supplies like ours, is to make them smarter. Alex Chadwick has a story now about smart grids where they really count.
Big, centralized energy systems, probably like the one allowing you to hear this, have lots of power. They have extra capacity and backup for big demand. Small systems balance energy and efficiency and expense more carefully. They have to be smart, like your cell phone is. Maybe the smartest energy system anywhere is being tested this summer in the most demanding sites in the world, combat outposts in Afghanistan, where costs are measured in more than dollars. because these combat outposts, they really are out a long way. Resupplying them means convoy routes, 100 miles maybe. We found this video on YouTube.
Go, go, go! Go!
To normal road hazards, fatigue, breakdowns, flat tires, add roadside bombs, an ambush, a rocket grenade.
Big one.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, the convoys became the great vulnerability. The chance of getting hit, 1 in 50. Maybe okay if you go once. These guys go all the time.
There's more coming. More on the route.
What is it they resupply? Lots of things. But two real essentials, water and diesel fuel. It's not hard to produce power. A diesel generator, some fuel, electricity. The trick is in managing the power because sometimes you want to be very, very efficient. At an experimental site on a gunnery range near Fort Bliss, El Paso, Texas, I'm learning this from a diesel mechanic named Alan Easterling.
What you have here is six 30 kW diesel engine-driven generators, and they're all tied into what we call a bus ring.
Bus ring. I'll come back to that and to Alan. But let me revisit that cell analogy from a moment ago. Smart energy is to energy, as your cell phone is to an old-fashioned telephone. The way things have been at remote army outposts, many generators run most of the time, each for one purpose, power the kitchen or the mess hall, for instance. That is bad, actually. For efficiency, diesel generators should run at 90% of their capacity. A lot of diesels running at 20 or 30% because that's the load they're carrying, well, you waste fuel and pretty soon the generators clog and stop working. What you need is a micro smart grid robust enough to operate in a really hostile environment. And that's what the Army is getting. It's been redesigning the basic combat outpost, and the new designs are assembled and built by a company called Berg, B-E-R-G, based in Spokane.
And that's when I talk about energy efficiency, that no one else has done that.
That's the CEO, Don Myers. Berg makes camps for extreme needs, disaster relief, mining, the military. The systems for what the Army is testing now, he says, are the most efficient camps in the world.
The other ones have little bits and pieces and little satellite operations that are under very restricted conditions here in the States. They have all sorts of engineers and technicians tweaking it, making it work. No one can field it like this to this point.
Okay, let's go back to the test site and the diesel guru, Alan Easterling. Do you remember what he said about that array of generators?
And they're all tied into what we call a bus ring.
A bus ring is a configuration of parts and sensors and a control device to read them. Instead of six generators limping toward the junkyard at half speed, the smart grid connects them all to each other and then loads all the demand onto one generator until it needs another. And everything works fine.
What we have here is the new X camp.
X for experimental. The combat outpost model they were testing at Fort Bliss in February, and that the Army is deploying now in Afghanistan.
It's a 100-man base camp. It comes with the billeting containers.
Billet, that's Army speak for where you live. A billet container is a living space for 10 people.
It comes with a small kitchen with a dining room.
Well, yeah, in another container, the X camp has to feed its 100 soldiers and care for them, so there's also one for sanitation.
It comes with two hygiene centers, showers on one side, latrines on the other side, and washers and dryers in them also.
This is the model for what will become the basic camp for the most dangerous places in the world, wherever they are, stripped to the essentials.
And we have a power grid that supplies the power for the camp.
Yeah, the grid. Because a smart grid cuts fuel needs by at least 50%, probably more. And that's why they are maniacal about efficiency and its sometimes tricky balance.
These are the most energy efficient machines that I believe they make.
Alan Easterling was a soldier for a dozen years, a consultant now for more than a dozen, the lead tech for assembling the X camps. He's telling me about the washers and dryers, the ones in the sanitation unit, for soldiers to do their laundry.
But they're too efficient for the soldiers. They're too efficient.
What do you mean by that?
It takes 6 hours for one person to wash their clothes and dry their clothes in this machine. Soldiers don't have 6 hours to wash their clothes at any time.
Even efficiencies come at a cost. The washer-dryers use very little power and very little water, but they pay for it with time. The combat outposts are in an early stage. Eventually, they'll lose the diesels. They'll go solar battery renewable. Smart grids can get much smarter. But for these people, cutting fuel demand by 50% means you can cut convoys by 50%, and that is huge. Just ask Alan Easterling. Currently in Afghanistan to build the first X camps and make sure they all work.
Because that guy's having to drive that truck miles and miles just to get to you to bring you fuel. So when you can cut fuel down, have fuel savings, water savings, you're saving lives. Really, really, you really are.
He'll be home again in August, he says. Probably back to work on a new, even more efficient X camp. From Bern, this is Alex Chadwick for Marketplace.
Alex Chadwick is the host of Bern, an energy journal from Sound Vision Productions, produced with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. If you want to try to wrap your head around the American power grid, we've got a video explainer on our website. It's marketplace.org. A good novel is going to have its fair share of tension, some intrigue, exotic locales maybe, and if you're really, really lucky, plenty of scenes set on a trading floor. Such is the case in the latest novel from Afrique Campbell. It's called On the Floor. Afrique, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So I'm a big one, and this is more about me than you need to know, but I'm a big one for reading that little blurb of the authors on the back of a book before I start digging in.
Right.
So the first thing I did was I flipped to that the back flap of the cover, noted that you had been at Morgan Stanley for 13 years. Then I read this book. And the question I have out of that is, why not just write a memoir instead of what I will grant you is a really good piece of fiction?
Although I was there and I knew the world, I wanted to tell a bigger story about that time, about the place, and about women and work. And, you know, sometimes if you – fiction is a great way of telling a story that everyone can engage in.
Yeah.
And I think it opens up a cast of characters that you can access, and you're freer to deal with material when it's not you.
Yeah, this is a story. It's a story about workplace and gender roles and dynamics and all of that stuff. I mean, it's there's a lot packed into, what, 100 and 200 and something pages, 240 pages?
It's a story in one way I think that's very straightforward. It's a story about love and money and a woman with a very particular mathematical talent who finds herself in a very unusual environment, which is a trading floor and a business world dominated by men. And although everything is going wonderfully for her, somehow she's not happy and things begin to unravel. I guess it's a story that a lot of us can relate to. She's smarter than most of the guys around her, but she lets herself be controlled.
I was trying to figure out what the extra character is in this book, and I can't decide whether it's the trading floor, which is a setting for a number of key scenes, or whether it's, in a more abstract sense, the market itself and the dynamics that that imposes on the behavior of all of the characters in this book.
I always felt, I started this book before the financial crisis, and it always amazed me that more people weren't interested in what was going on inside the world of finance. You know, it really took a crisis for everybody to start paying attention. And really, you know, a trading floor is economics in action. It's like a cross between a newsroom, a racetrack, a maths lab, a football match. You see decision-making and performance under intense pressure. To me, it was an obvious environment to set a story in. The problem was how to bring people in and make the reader feel like they're there.
This may well be none of my business, but since I've got you on the phone, I'm going to ask you anyway. What's it like as a woman in that environment? I mean, obviously, you did it for 13 years, so you know it and you liked it in some degree.
I loved it. I loved the job. I found it incredibly challenging. I found it really interesting. I mean, it's really difficult when you talk about the markets now because in this environment there's so much negative sentiment. So it's hard to make people understand that you can really engage in a job like that. It stretches you. It stretches you to find how you can perform in those conditions, and it's also very interesting.
This book is set back in 1991 in the lead up to the original Gulf War. And I mention that as a way to set up this next question. One of the characters in this book is a quant, one of the PhDs in statistics and numbers and all that stuff, that have become so important today. But I'm guessing you felt it necessary to make that statement, right? That was intentional.
That was really important to me because while I was working in the business, that's exactly what happened. I mean, the seeds of the crisis were sown way back then, and everything changed. Attitudes towards risk, size, speed, all of the things that contributed to the carnage that we saw unfold later. It was a culture shift, and it laid the foundation for everything that would unravel with a vengeance.
The most recent book by Afrique Campbell is called On the Floor. It's about the trading floor in London. Afrique, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which I deliver with just a tinge of weight. What? The Pew Research Center, as it does from time to time, has asked Americans to rate certain professions by their perceived contribution to society. The top five in order were the military, teachers, doctors, scientists, and then engineers. They were, in fact, the only jobs rated as contributing a lot to society by more than half of all Americans. Journalists, and the source of my, wait, what, came in at 28%. That is down from the last time Pew asked this question. To which all I can say is, hey, at least we beat the lawyers. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 169 points, record high. 0.1% is the percentage gain there. The NASDAQ up 57 points, 1.6%. The S&P 500 up 22 points, 1.4%. Another record there. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.